a poem by Jack Gilbert. Sorrow everywhere, slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they are starving somewhere else, with flies in their nostrils. But we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the morning before summer dawn would not be made so fine. The Bengal tiger would not be fashioned so miraculously well. The poor women at the fountain are laughing together between the suffering they have known and the awfulness of their future, smiling and laughing while somebody in the village is very sick. There is laughter every day in the terrible streets of Calcutta, and the women laugh in the cages of Bombay. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not joy. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. If the locomotive of the Lord runs us down, we should give thanks that the end had magnitude. We must admit there will be music despite everything. We stand at the bow again of a small ship, anchored late at night in the tiny port, looking over to the sleeping island. The waterfront is three shuttered cafes and one naked light burning. To hear the faint sound of oars in the silence as a rowboat comes slowly out and then goes back is truly worth all the years of sorrow that have yet to come. So we are now on our sixth talk in the series, Riding the Ox Home. It took me, I just got home yesterday from riding the airplane home, and it was a little slower than the ox. It took me 48 hours to get from Boston to here. It was unbelievable. And the talk is midway through the series, and it's a special talk because there's a turnaround that has happened here we have to be careful that we don't bypass. Let me first start off by reading the placard that we have all these eight ox herding pictures on, and read number six. It says, Riding the Ox Home. Following the winding road, you ride the ox home. The sound of your rustic flute pervades the evening breeze. Each note, each song, feeling unbounded beyond lips and mouth. So there's a significant turnaround. Up until this point, you can see the struggle of the young man who's trying to make his life work around a spiritual tradition, and the struggle that that ensues as he chases after the ideal. And then suddenly he catches a glimpse and begins to tug and fight his way on board. And something happens between the fourth and the sixth picture there, where there's suddenly a calmness befalls between the struggling young man and his true nature, the ox. And up until this point, the sense of himself has been so predominant that it's felt like a struggle to get to anything that's intrinsic, to any natural harmony within himself. Yet somewhere in this middle section, we find him at first in section 5 leading the ox, and then suddenly he's on the back of the ox playing a flute. There's no more tension between himself and the animal. And it's such an important component of the practice to understand what's happened in these last few frames, because it's really where the force of my teaching goes, and the force of many teachers, to start understanding that what we most desperately long for us, for ourselves, is intrinsic to ourselves. It's not something that we have to do in betterment of what we already are. We don't have to go out and labor so intensively to get something that seems to be an add-on, a cultivation. What we find, and we slip into it, it's interesting because most of the states that we most appreciate in meditation, we have slipped into. We haven't created through the white-knuckle approach of bearing down and forcing this to happen, but rather almost by chance, almost very suddenly, in the off moments when we expecting nothing and relaxed within the moment, that some of these transformative insights and experiences do occur. And from those quick flashes, we think it was a mistake. We think, well, that happened to me once, but it hasn't happened since. Well, why hasn't it happened since? Because you've been looking for it since it's happened to you to reoccur. And so there's been a tension that we carry within our sitting to try to replicate those moments in which we think the divine has occurred. And we get very confused because the harder we try, the more dense we feel, the more distant we feel, the more separate we feel, and the further we feel from that more open, expansive, sudden awareness that was so available at that odd moment. And over time, we sense that we're working this thing from the wrong end, that we can't force this thing. It just won't happen according to our control or our demands or our blueprint, and certainly not according to our timing. And so it's very perplexing. It's very awkward to face that moment because essentially, even though ultimately we see the burden is off of us because we can't do it, where is the burden lying then? If we can't do it and it still isn't happening, what's going to make this thing happen? And we're lost. We're completely lost to what we can do. Now that loss has a very, very sharp edge, but it also has an extraordinary gentleness to it. The sharp edge is the sense that we're completely bewildered. We know without irrevocably, that our efforts aren't going to make it happen. And at the same time, nothing's happening. And what's going to make this thing happen? How's it going to move forward? I really see my own impotence in my spiritual work, but at the same time, I'm not where I want to be. And there's this friction between those two, which we're completely lost. And if we are directed in the right way, a new opening arises. A new possibility arises from here. We begin to see that the more gentle we are within that space, the more accepting and relaxed we become. And the, it's like fall, like falling through, like Alice in Wonderland, falling through the, what, rabbit hole. It just, the rabbit hole just opens for us. But it opens in completely a contradictory way than we've been living our life. And it's, we don't have any, now we've lost all strategies because we've been working this way in association and in accompanying with the way my life has worked up until now. But now that has, I've seen the end of that. And I, by mistake, find my way into a new orientation to myself, and suddenly this gateless gate opens. Now what happens is that we have learned to be gentle. I can't think of another way around this. I can't put a different word on it because it's so obvious that when we are willing not to create the boundaries, the forced resistances, the defenses, the need to get over our life, to get on with our life, to get through our life, the need for our life to become something, to mean something to me, when we can settle back within the living of life rather than the products of what that life will bring me, when we can settle back within the living of life, the experience of that is gentleness. It feels gentle. Tensionless living, effortless practice. From something that I've cultivated to something I'm now abiding within. The sure heart's release, said the Buddha. The sure heart's release. And the scripts that we now follow are scripts that encourage a deepening sense of repose within our life, a deepening sense of receptivity and relaxation within our life. In fact, I call them the four R's of living, and those are relaxing, that sense of tensionless existence, releasing the need to influence or control or to lean in, to circumstantially lean in, to put our weight into the moment, Relinquishing our need to validate ourselves constantly, which is much of our activity, and rejoining, which means reconnecting, interconnectedness, relaxing, releasing, relinquishing, and rejoining. And it's very much like a melting snow person. Politically correct all the way. Just to digress for a moment, I was at IMS and the person bringing the mail was coming up, and I said, it was a woman, and I said, "Hello, mail person." Didn't feel right. Anyway, so this snow person is melting in front of us. And it doesn't, but the dying tendencies to keep accentuating ourselves don't just leave, for the most part, on the very rare exception that I've heard about, but I have not seen myself. there are people, it is said, that never turn back, that just keep melting. But that has not been my experience, nor the people that I have witnessed. There's a thawing and a melting and a refreeze and a thawing and a refreeze. And as we go in and out of the freezer. And so this snowman woman holds his or her shape for a long period of time. So we have an ox and we have a person on top of the ox. We have harmony within our practice. We are certainly in alignment with the authentic and natural expression of ourselves riding on the back of the ox, and yet there is a person that is very visibly there. And that sense of person who is very visibly there has a sense of themselves as being awake. In fact, in Zen, it's called the stink of enlightenment. I like that because that's pretty much the way it is. We can become extraordinary arrogance in our emptiness. So there's still a face to presence, is another way of saying it. It's still happening too. Still happening too. Have you noticed? And I'm not suggesting that we're all to the point where we're on the back of the ox, but in some way, I know many of you can follow this talk in whatever level of practice, because you've had moments in which something where presence or awareness has just been a natural, you haven't had to work for it, it's just there. You look around, you're not efforting, you're just being present, being in presence. You're not even being, you're being in presence. Presence is much bigger than the little sense of me who used to be working very hard to achieve this goal. And then a sudden fear comes up, oh my God, I don't want to lose it. As if you made it to begin with. What you made, you can lose. But what you didn't make, you can't lose. It never dawns on us that all we can do is think our way out of this thing. But we can't think our way into it. And so in the moment in which we aren't having thought, we find ourselves there, then we try to think our way back into what just happened, which is exactly the reverse of what did happen. So we tie ourselves into an enormous knot because the mind is still very much in control. And that sense of the mind being in control is the sense of the person being on the back of the ox. He may not be steering the ox at this point, but he is very present on the back of the ox. And there's that self-awareness that is a component part of the awareness of presence as well. Now, I want to just, none of this I had any, it's not written. So I'm like deviating, okay? So you just, I don't know where it's going, but we're going to go for a while. Okay. So I want to give you a metaphor that some of you have heard if you're at Hollyhock, but you'll bear with me here because I think it's relevant. And that is that what's happening is that the human being, the sense of me, the sense of us, the sense of I, the self, is four-dimensional. It has the dimensions of height, width, depth, and time. We consist of four dimensions. I mean, we carry time in us, but we very much think of ourselves as being in time. I have a past and a future, and the present moment is something that I'm passing through on my way to the future, having come from the past. So we feel like it feels like a way station on a way to somewhere else, right? So we carry time very much as a byproduct of the way we hold ourselves. Now, the now, capital N-O-W, the now is only three dimensions, right? It has infinite space, height, and width, but it has no time. Because now, listen to the word, now, how can it hold time? Because it's now. There's no time there. You see? Okay, so now how, here's the question, how can a four-dimensional object find its way into three dimensions? Well, there's only one way to do that, and that's to lose one of the dimensions. So that three can match three, it's like putting a square block in a round hole. You aren't going to be able to fit it in that way. But by losing the dimension of time, it fits very nicely. So how do we lose the dimension of time? Well, so happens that the sense of self is entirely composed of time. If we think of who we are, we're an image. We know ourselves from what we have done and what we plan or worry about doing. And we have all the traits that we can account for from our past and all the projects that we're working on in the future. Right? So the sense of me and the image that's formed around that sense of me is embedded within time, within my thoughts about what I'm doing, where I've been, where I'm going. And for us to actually be present now, to be in now, I have to release time. I think that's a very clear way of looking at the spiritual journey, not in terms of cultivations, and it's looking at it in terms of something very accessible that we're not willing to give up. How hard can it be to be now, now? What is now happening? See, it's not somewhere else, right? It's now. And therefore, it must be very easy to take a seat in now. But we find it extraordinarily difficult. In fact, we spend decades, lifetimes, according to some literature, doing just that. Why is it so difficult? Because we refuse to give up the image of ourselves to get there. The image is only an idea we have that we've placed over the actual experience that we're having. But that idea holds, we invest so much into that idea that it feels like if we gave it up, we'd be giving our whole lives up. That our lives would be purposeless, meaningless, directionless. Who wants a directionless life? So our mind, which is the formative, it's the way the idea forms is within the mind, thinks ahead of itself and says, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go to some place where I don't exist. And it conceives of what I don't exist must look like. Emptiness, haunted house, devil worship, I don't know. But it sets it up to be hideous and then says, something in me is pulling me towards it because everything that's not an idea would love to get there. It's just the idea that doesn't want to get there. So we have this tremendous lure towards now because we are in now and we're just thinking our way out of now. Is this making sense? Okay, so I'm using a lot of... Okay. So the fact that there's such enormous longing and yearning for freedom is because we're already there. We just keep thinking our way out of there. And we keep losing that resonance when we think our way out. And yet every cell in our body is emanating from here and now. And so all we are doing, is simply letting go of an idea called an image. And I framed it in this way, and I think it's good. I don't even know where I framed it, but it's in there somewhere. I framed it as turning the unconscious somebody into the conscious nobody. That's all they were doing. Because the image of me is unconscious. It's unconscious. It hasn't been attended to. It would love to be attended to, Because then we, but we know that if we do attend to it, we'll see holes in it. So that's the last thing we want to attend. And so we don't. What we do instead of attending to where we need to attend, to come into the now, which we've never left. You see how ridiculous this is? It's like it scrambles my tongue to even say it. And I lost my train of thought. So all we have to do is to pay attention to ourselves. We have to make the unconscious conscious. But when we sit down, we can't find ourselves. I mean, really, if we're quiet, if we're just quiet and serious, you have to be serious. You can't. You have to want this because that's the heart. That's the now wanting itself. That's the mother wanting its child. The now wants itself. It wants to rejoin, but the sense of self doesn't want to rejoin. The sense of self wants to keep this a project, something that I can master in the future, but not now. I can do it later, but not now. And as long as I can say that, I'll stay formed. I will stay formed, working out my salvation in the future, but not settling now, not doing it now. And that future, of course, never arrives. Never arrives. And so the hardest thing for anyone to do in meditation is to understand, or to see their image. Because the image is like a greased pig. Because every time we see an image, we're seeing it from our image. Every time we look at anything, we're looking at it from something that's looking, and the identification goes back one step to what's now observing what I'm looking at. You see? And so we don't want to be conscious, totally conscious. We want to have a working relationship with our spiritual journey that keeps the slippery pig, the greased pig, just a couple of squeezes back. Am I getting myself in a mess? Okay. There's one saving grace. But we have to make it a saving grace. And that is the saving grace of self-love. That we care about ourselves. You see, at some point we open our hearts sufficiently in whatever ways we're trying to avoid ourselves. Something happens where we actually open to ourselves in a brief moment of time and some compassion comes out and we go, my God, I hurt. And I care that I hurt. I care that I hurt. Because it's not good enough just to say you hurt, because then, so what? So there's a lot of people out there just keep your nose to the grindstone. The cultural imperatives of keeping working straightforward, and so what you hurt, just buckle up and quit moaning and complaining and move forward. Okay, that's what it means to hurt. But when we care we hurt, when we care we hurt, then our heart is open to our pain. That is a prerequisite for the turnaround. That is the prerequisite. We have to care that we hurt. When we care that we hurt, and we don't hold ourselves in contempt, which many of us do for our entire life. You see why we have to be somebody before we can be nobody? We don't have to be just anybody. We have to be a caring somebody. We have to actually consider ourselves. And then, when we are genuinely compassionate to ourselves, which means we care about our pain, we're interested in where that pain comes from. What's the derivation of this thing? Because caring really wants to end it. It doesn't want to perpetuate it with a stiff upper lip. It wants to end it. And when it's serious at that level, at only that level, are we willing to face the image? No other level. See, this is a heart game. Thank God. Because anything else would rob us of our dignity and leave us cold. But this does not. This does not. This doesn't leave a single breath that we take outside of our heart. And it is from that willingness to turn and face the pain of our life. And I can't keep reinforcing this. I know some of you are saying, oh, he's on the pain thing again. Well, I am. Because we have a whole set of assumptions around that pain. That is the crucible in where the image is actually formed, is within the pain, the form of the sense of self, the running from that, the distancing, the unconscious lurching out of the darkness of that unconscious pain towards anything that will relieve this pain. Get this pain away from me. Give me some distance to this pain. That is the formation of the self. Now, how can that lurching resolve itself except by turning back in on that which it is lurching from? Because it is there that the hardened and most deeply believed areas, the assumptions that we have never turned to because we know they're true, the patterns that hold everything true about me and all the secrets I refuse to tell my most beloved partner or friend. The part of us that says, if you really knew me, you wouldn't want to know me. That part. That's where we're formed. But its expression, because that boundary, that fire is so hot, the resistances permutate beyond that in countless, countless subcategories. And we find the pain of our resistance in the boundary formation of our sense of image moving far out, far reaching, but all held within usually one central principle, one central idea about ourselves. And so we have to look at why we want to be somebody. Why do I want to be? Why do I want to be? Why do I want to be somebody? We look at the very basic, the very creative process itself. It's almost as if on whatever day God created heaven and earth and created life, whatever day that happened in the Old Testament, it's like we have to be present at that day, at that moment when we were created, because we are being created moment after moment from the residues of my own ignorance, from the blindness of my own turning away, from the unconscious an unwillingness to see what this thing is. And even when we see it, even when the ox is known, even when we are relaxed upon the back of this great beast, called living, called presence, called wonderment, called majesty, called love, even when we're on the back of this great beast, still, the tendencies, the long, enduring tendencies, as long as human beings have been around, they have inscribed to the unconscious fleeing of their image. And that chronicle of aversion lies within each of our common conscious minds. The words are dramatically said so that we can feel the power of this momentum. This is not just done. For most people, but now what does being done mean when we understand that being done is simply living, simply expressing, simply allowing life to express itself through our veins, through the natural heat waves of life in which I'm one expression, one manifestation, one arising into being in this moment, just arising into being in this moment. It feels as if when it's seen in relationship to the ox, it feels as if it's seen as if because there's an inward eye that can actually see it as such. Sometimes it's like being on the film of a soap bubble. This is a very poor analogy, but being on the film of, and the sense of me is the film of the soap bubble. And the sense of infinite space that lies behind and in front. And we're just like a little, just one molecule thick on that thing. Not stillness, but resounding stillness. Stillness that is heard through the course of all humanity, of all beings. And a part of us, a part of that pain, and the pain is quickly alleviated from attention, from consciousness. We bring conscious attention to what is unconscious. That's how the unconscious becomes conscious. All we have to do is be willing to observe. That is all we have to do. We don't have to be willing to fix it, change it, but the observation has to hold caring, or it holds contempt. The purity of the observation will determine the quickness of the resolution. Because if the observation holds contempt, that is the basic way that we feel about ourselves, is contemptuous, then we will form ourselves, our image, from the very observation itself. So we begin to see how serious this thing is. But the beauty of it is that even though each moment, each layer of the onion shows that we have to even be more subtle than what we have been in the previous layer of the onion, the heart provides the resources to do just that. It provides a deepening quiet, a deepening resolve, a deepening sincerity, a deepening caring, so that it matches, in fact, it matches it a huge number, 1 plus 20,000 zeros is the problem, and we match it with 1 plus 20,000 zeros, 0.1. It's just enough. It's just enough. 1 trillion and 1/10 meets 1 trillion. You following this? What I'm trying to show is that we always have it. We always have that capacity. If we want it, we can call it forth. If we don't want it, or if we're there for other reasons, other motivations, then we'll have 999,999.9. One-tenth less than what we need, which is just enough to keep the image going. I'll get out of numbers real quick here. Also, I haven't gotten off the first page. So I think it's, first of all, important to know that the solution, the ox, is like licking us. It's like this. It's like this huge bowl that loves us. That's like, I'm going to digress because I went to an open zoo in Squim or someplace. So we went to this open zoo because we didn't have anything to do in the afternoon. So we went to this open zoo, and they were like buffalo walking around, and they give us this big loaf of bread to feed the buffalo. So we rolled down the window, and this buffalo comes over to the car, and my wife says, "It's going to come into the car. It's going to come into the car." No, it's not. I'm holding the loaf of bread on my lap, and this buffalo sticks its head. And slobbers, this slobbering buffalo. And I'm yelling, "Ellen, get him out of here! Ellen, get him out of here!" Oh my. So therein lies the ox. So we can. It's there. It can't be closer. How can it be closer? How can now be closer? How can now be closer? I mean, just sit with that. Just ask that question. How can now be closer? That's a beautiful question. I just thought of it. How can now possibly be closer? And you say, okay, well, it can't. I mean, that's logical. It can't. So then why does it seem to be, why am I betraying it? Why am I betraying it? Because that's what we have to come to. It's not betraying me. If something is as accessible as the skin on our body, and we don't realize it's that accessible, which is it? Is it the skin that's betraying us, or is it the sense that we don't recognize how close it is? And if we don't, what can we do? What can we do? We can't do anything because anything we do drives the thinking, which is the distance and the separation, and increases the distance and separation from us. Please understand this. I don't know how many more meetings I have in me. And I don't want to come into this culture called Seattle and leave it. And everybody could go back to their lives. That was interesting. What happened? I don't know. Back to work. If we can't wake up together, what are we doing? You know, we have fun, we laugh. We meet as a sangha, as a gathering. We share the warmth, which is beautiful, because that's the oven, that's the crucible of love. But there also has to be a driving intention. To resolve whatever the resolution, whatever we're fixed on the problem where we can't see it. Let's end this thing. Best done in community, where shoulder to shoulder, the synergy of courage and wishing each other forward to their advantage, in their timing, and in their way. If it was something impossible, if it were a journey where only a few of us could make, then we could tally. We could delay. We could spend some time chatting about what we wanted to do as, but it's not. How far could now be? How distant could it possibly be? And when we ask the sobering question, what is it? How am I obscuring this thing? Then it's not to try to do more. It's not to strengthen our muscles to try to get over something, because to get over something is taking us further away from now. Getting over anything is getting over now. Everything is from now. Everything is emanating from now. It has to emanate from now. What else could anything come from? And therefore, everything has to be included in order for now to be awakened. That means all aspects of ourselves. That means every component of our minds. That means turning away from nothing. Making everything conscious is another way of saying it. Everything becomes light because everything is light of now. So we turn away from nothing. We obscure nothing. Because we care about everything, we realize we could never, ever be separate from the ox. And this whole thing, it has to do with timing. And, okay, timing. Can't force it, so what else can it be but timing? If I can't force it, then it has to be timing. But within that timing is a crystal clear willingness to awaken to what is unconscious in ourselves. We feel a reaction, we're right there. We get lost in the trance of thought and we open. What just occurred there? And we see that the more we focus in on the image of self, the more we will be pretentious, and the more we will lie, and the more unethical we will become. Because what we're interested in is not the ethics, not the unification of ethics, but the personification of me. And I will do anything, distort the truth or do whatever I need to in order for the sense of me to be more delineated and distinct from you. And so I'll pontificate about my accomplishments when I didn't have them. I will lie about who I am. It has to go unethically. It has to. When that is our focus. But when our focus is joining now, it's just the opposite. It's the truth. We have to go with the truth, because anything other than the truth just distances myself from now. Because any reason I would tell a lie or disown a part of life is to separate myself off with more distinction. But if I don't care about being distinct from, then I don't care about lying, fabricating, distorting. And we see the salvation. We see the salvation. Relax. Just relax. But keep your eyes open. It's not a call for indulgence. It's a call for rapture, the rapt attention. and let it unfold right in front of our eyes, the miraculous unfolding right in front of our eyes. What could be more of a delight than to share a world where other people are doing the same? Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if you have any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to respond to them if I can. Yes, Robbie.
Today, I had a man, I took out a man who I take out once a week. We go out and have lunch.
So the question is around having done something that this person feels very guilty about having done, and at the same time, moments in which the joy of life comes in, but then in the absence of that particular stimulation that raises the joy, there is, in the quiet comes the guilt back. This is not uncommon to any of us. All of us have had and done things which we have remorse for, guilt. And it's an important way to understand how to work with guilt. We have to understand each of the way the mind reforms itself. Okay, so understand what the mind is trying to do through guilt. It's taking a past occurrence and showing how you weren't up to living that occurrence in a perfect way. You weren't perfect. And because you had greater expectations of yourself after the event, you can look back and say, oh, I didn't live up to my expectations, etc., etc. Okay, so guilt is where we have failed. But what happens when we feel guilt is that the image of ourselves as failures becomes very strong. And so the mind has successfully condoned or condemned you into an image through that sense of guilt. And then there's a moment because where you're not, the circumstances of that incident aren't there, and you can feel the joy of life, and a moment the guilt is not there. It's not that you have, that it's just on the bookshelf waiting to be picked up again. In those moments, it's not there. And then, in the quiet, the memory comes back in and closes you back down and cordons you off into the guilt again. What are we going to do? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You go right to that incident, bring it up in memory, and you stay right there with it. And you don't excuse yourself. You don't pretend better things happen than what actually happened. You don't ridicule yourself. You just stay with the actual occurrence of what did happen. And you feel the pain of your limitation in that moment. You feel the pain. And you just let it burn itself out at that level. Don't move from it. What you begin to realize with any awareness is that given the situation in that moment, you acted the only way you could act. Not the only way you should have acted, but the only way you could have acted, given what you were carrying, what the circumstances was, whatever the situation, there wasn't another option for you. Although post-trauma, there certainly seems to be other options, but there wasn't in that moment. You acted, probably unconsciously, to a whole set of conditions that led to this particular result. And you then see that you have learned something from that moment in which that occurred and all of the remorseful remembrances. You have learned something through all of that. You learned a certain blindness in you or a certain different way you could have been more sensitive or something. And so actually the person who's now looking back has changed. It is no longer the same person who perpetrated the guilt. And so you have already should be forgiven because you've already moved beyond that limited perspective. the sense of you, the image of you, has moved, has learned, has broadened. At that point, when you realize that, you say, that's it. You realize what the mind is doing. You realize that you've garnered everything you possibly could from that moment in which you were limited in your, and that you've grown. And then you say, okay, mind, I got you. I see you, Mara. I see you, Mara. Now you turn the radio back on and listen to your songs in joy. Because there is nothing else that can happen except you can learn. That's it. That's the, everything else is just a mental attempt to keep you bound in time. And when you see that, you refuse to play that game. Do you become heartless? No. You become heartful. In fact, the more you ascribe and believe in your guilt, the more it assures that you will act similarly when the same situation occurs, because you will be so tight within the shadow of yourself from the guilt and the righteousness that the blindness will continue and you won't have learned a thing. Learn and move on. Learn and move on.